Good morning.
Good morning.
It is a beautiful morning. So, Thich Nhat Hanh writes simply and eloquently about interdependence, which is a basic Buddhist tenet. And he wrote an essay entitled Nature and Nonviolence. And in that essay he says, you don't discriminate between the seed and the plant. You see that they inter-are with each other, that they are the same thing. Looking deeply at the young corn stalk, you can see the seed of corn still alive, but with a new appearance. The plant is the continuation of the seed. The practice of meditation helps us to see things other people can't see. We look deeply and we see that father and son, father and daughter, mother and son, mother and daughter, corn seed and corn stalk have a very close relationship. That is why we should awaken to the fact, to the truth, that we inter are. The suffering of one is the suffering of the other. When we see that, we and all living beings are made of the same nature, how can there be division between us? And he also wrote a poem about interdependence that I would like to share with you. It's quite well known, and you may have read it. It's a little long, but I want to read the whole thing. It's called Call Me by My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with wings still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear pond, and I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughs at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open. The door of compassion. Excuse me. So all things are related. And if we don't acknowledge this and act accordingly, then we don't act skillfully and it causes suffering. We cannot deal with things in isolation. Life doesn't give us the luxury of that simplicity. If we do something without thinking through all the results that may come from our action, we get into trouble. In practice period, which just concluded, we were looking at bodhisattva action in the world. Many of you were there. And I encouraged folks to come up with some kind of a vow. And my vow crystallized around the idea of othering. To be effective in the world, to be true to the complexity of the world, we can't dismiss anything or anyone as the other. This means we can't hate any group of people, for example, for that group is us, and to hate them is like hating our own hand, and to hurt them is like cutting off our own hand. And this includes people we don't like, and this includes the worst people of all, and that makes it really hard. When I was something of an activist the first time around, I often engaged in othering. I didn't realize it, but I did this. I needed an other. I needed a good enemy. I wanted my enemy to be pure, to be purely bad. I was a little disappointed when I found out that the tobacco company executive was really nice to his children. I didn't want to believe it. I didn't want to believe that there were seeds of kindness in him, and I didn't want to believe that there were seeds of unkindness in me, and that we were, in fact, very much alike, even if, from my point of view, at least, we varied as to what we allowed to grow from these seeds. So I recently had a sort of lesson in interdependence that I'd like to share with you. So I'm going to tell you a story, and it's a story about DNA. And it started about a year ago when Kathy got me a DNA test for my birthday. Probably some of you have had this done. It wasn't very expensive, and the process was really simple. I deposited some saliva into a little tube, and I sent it off, and I had my results within 10 days. And I was pretty curious. I had a pretty good idea of what I would find, because my mom, back in the days before the internet and before DNA tests, had done a lot of genealogical research laboriously over years. So I know that I'm in part Dutch, that's the Overrockers, and English, that's the Matchetts, and Irish, that's the O'Tooles, French, that's the Bovees, Scottish, that's the Hardys and the Ogilvies, and German, that's the Carpenters, who were the Zimmermans in Germany before they came here. And also I was told that I had a bit of Native American blood as well. So that's seven different ethnicities. And when I got the results, there were no big surprises. I should explain that these results are not as exact as you might think. Your DNA results don't necessarily show your ethnicities in the exact proportion that you got them from your ancestors, as you might expect. And so two siblings can actually have results that are quite different. So the proportions I'm going to tell you about may not be exact in one sense, but I'm willing to take it as true for purposes of this talk. And the other source of inexactitude is that, when it comes to Western Europe, the breakdown isn't as fine as you might expect. There's a category called Great Britain, which includes Scotland and also a fairly big chunk of the continent. And there's a category called Western Europe, which doesn't break it down any further than that. So here's what I got. Great Britain, 57%. I think that's probably the English, the Scottish, and the Dutch, but I can't be sure. Western Europe, 25%. That's probably the French and German. So I'm probably made up 82% of mostly those six ethnicities that I expected. No big surprise. So there weren't any big surprises, but I tell you, there were a lot of little surprises. First of all, there was no Native American blood. So either those family stories weren't true or it just didn't show up in my particular case. And then there was Irish, 8%. And that's more than I expected, actually. I knew that my father was descended from one Daniel O'Toole who came over here in the 1700s, and he was Irish. And that's where our name came from. But I didn't know there was any more Irish blood than that. It turns out there was Irish blood on my mom's side, too. I say blood. It would be more accurate to say DNA, but blood is the way I'm used to talking about it. So, Scandinavian, 4%. That's Norwegian, Swedish, or Danish. That was a total surprise to me. No one had ever said anything about Scandinavian blood, and I wondered, where did it come from? And one of my buddies, who also had this done, suggested that it could have come in through the Irish. It could have had something to do with marauding Vikings, which sounds kind of funny in a way, but really it's deadly serious. Sometimes DNA comes into your blood unwillingly. Next, Middle Eastern, 2%. Total surprise. Who knew? Where did it come from? No idea. Iberian, 1%. This is Spain or Portugal. North African, less than 1%. Finland, Northwest Russia, less than 1%. And finally, European Jewish, less than 1%. So it appears that I'm a mixture of at least 13 different ethnicities. So no wonder I'm so weird and complex and confused. And so religiously curious. I'm descended from Muslims, Jews, Christians, and pagans. And of course, I'm especially curious about how these traces came into my bloodline. I was reading a column in the Pioneer Press by Ruben Rosario. He had a similar test done, and he got some similar results, but with way different proportions. And based on what he said, I realized that the North African, and maybe the Middle Eastern, could have come in with the Iberian because of the Moors in Spain. And the Jewish blood as well, perhaps, because there were a lot of Jews in Spain. And then it occurred to me that my great-grandfather, Will Beauvais, was French, and France is next to Spain. So maybe that's where that came in. I would like to research that. Maybe I could find out. And all of this to me was nothing but exciting and good news. And these are small traces, but I am happy to report that, in addition to the things I knew about, I am Scandinavian, and I am an Arab, and I am also a Jew, and I am Hispanic, and I'm Finnish, or Russian. And that's great. I am connected by blood, by DNA, by this very stuff in my body, to more of the world than I ever suspected. And it gives me a more obvious connection to what happens in Palestine and Israel and Syria and Moscow, as well as Paris, Berlin, and Dublin. And one wonders how many people who hate a certain group actually share DNA with that group and don't know about it. And of course, all of us, regardless of our ethnicity, are completely bound up with what happens in these other places. The 13 different ethnicities, in my case, just help to dramatize it a little bit. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive, Thich Nhat Hanh said. We're all Arabs, we're all Jews, we're all African, we're all Asian, we're all Aboriginals, we're all white. And there is no other. There is just one human family. And we must act accordingly. So that's part one of my talk. That's the joyful part. The second part starts out joyfully, and it starts out being fun, actually, but it gets difficult. So the DNA service that I used not only tells you your ethnicity, it alerts you to various people that they think you may be related to who have also had that test done, and they allow you to contact them in a way that everyone can preserve their anonymity if they wish. And there was a person identified as my likely second cousin, and I contacted her. And she said that she was indeed my second cousin and that she had done a lot of genealogical research on her own and that her name was Janine. And by the way, I told her all about this talk and what it was going to be, and she's totally cool with it. And I'm so grateful to her for that and for helping me understand my family history. And I said to her, you know, Kathy and I are going on vacation this August. We're going to be in your area. We could stop in. And she said, great. So we did. We met her in Mason City, Iowa, at the public library in the genealogy room, which was a really cool place. And the first thing I said was, wow, you really look like a carpenter, because she really did. And the first thing we did was we got our relationship straight. Her grandfather was Oliver Burris Carpenter, and he was the brother of my grandfather on my mom's side, Harry Robert Carpenter, whom everyone knew as Bob. So her grandfather, Oliver Burris Carpenter, some called him OB, some called him Oliver, I think. My mom always called him Uncle Burris. And I thought I remembered him, and I asked her, did he have a couple of fingers missing on one of his hands? And she said, yes. And I said, I remember him. When I was really little, maybe 3 or 4 years old, we went to a nursing home and we visited this guy. And I remember he tapped on the wall with that hand, with those fingers missing. That made a bit of an impression on me. And I still remember it to this day. And he died not too long after that. So whether I ever met Janine in person when we were children, I don't know. We lived maybe 100 miles apart. But I was delighted to find out that she has the carpenter thumb. And for you people listening online, and maybe you people in the back row, I have to describe this thumb that we have. This is not an elegant, aristocratic thumb. This is a short, squat, serviceable farmer's thumb. And my mom had this thumb really bad. She had the carpenter thumb so bad that her thumbnail was twice as wide as it was long. And we teased her about it all the time, and she just laughed. She loved it. It was distinctive, and it connected her with her father. And it came in really handy for me because it was a great hitchhiking thumb. You could see it from far away. So after we took a picture of our thumbs side by side, she handed me this printout. And here it is. It is entitled Ancestors of Ted Allen Toole, the Carpenter Line. She used my old name. I changed my name to O'Toole to get more in touch with my Irish roots about 9 years ago. And this printout is 127 pages long, and it traces the various branches of the Carpenter family back as far as she's been able to go. And in one case, it goes back 20 generations to someone named Elizabeth Baroness Great Bromley Essex Ardley, who was born in 1454 in Great Bromley Essex in England. And her husband, Simon Ardley Essex Stone, he only had four names, was born in 1450 also in Essex. So that's 567 years of family history, which is pretty cool. So apparently I had an ancestor who was a baroness, and I wish to note that that was the only trace of royalty I could find in this entire history. And when I first read the printout, I was kind of glad about that, because I thought one aristocrat is plenty, because, you know, I'm a man of the people. And then I realized how odd that was, because what was I doing there? I was othering my own blood. How odd to other your own blood. I like the farmers, but I don't like the royalty. But really, I don't have a choice, right? I am connected to them all. So the carpenter side was German, Dutch, Scottish, English, and Irish. There were a lot of Bavarians. There was also Elizabeth Katharina Niece, born in 1644 in Odessa, Russia. So maybe that's the Russo-Finnish part. I don't know. But now we get to the hard part. And if you ever decide to get a DNA test or research your family history, be prepared, because you may find things you don't like. So for background, I have to trace my Grandpa Bob's line, the Carpenters. My Grandpa Bob was born in 1894. He lived on a small farm near Milford in northwest Iowa. He had a sixth grade education. He was pretty poor his whole life. And he had the biggest heart and the most wonderful equanimity. And I loved him and my grandma, whose name was Celia, Nee Bovee, beyond what any words can express. And summers I would get to stay with them on their little farm. It was about 60 or 70 acres, and that was my paradise. And he lived to be 101 years old, so I got to be with him for a long, long time. He died when I was about 41. So Grandpa Bob's father, who was the great-grandfather I had in common with Janine, don't worry, there won't be a test on these things, was Robert Tally Carpenter, married to Dora Bell Matchett, and they lived in central Iowa in Powashik County. And his father was Albert Harrison Carpenter, married to Louisa M. Spooner. He was born in Kentucky, and she was born in North Carolina. So people kept moving west, and in my case, a little bit north. And I have a picture of Albert Harrison Carpenter, my great-great-grandfather, taken in the late 1800s. And I know most of you can't see this very well. He's standing stiffly, and he's wearing a formal-looking coat, and he has a long beard, and he looks like you might expect the patriarch of the Hatfields or the McCoys to look, I think. He's not holding a rifle, but you can bet he carried one. His father was Levi, married to Susanna Liza Moore. They were both born in 1797 in Kentucky. And his father, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, was Michael Carpenter, born around 1765 in Kentucky. He was married to Elizabeth Cassidy. She was born in Maryland or Virginia. So here it is. Here's the thing. This is Michael Carpenter's will from the probate records of Bath County, Kentucky. In the year of our Lord, 1834, I, Michael Carpenter, dying or taking into consideration that man is born to die, and being in a low state of body, but thank God in my right mind, do in the name of God, amen, make this my last will and testament. First, I commit my body to the dust and my spirit to God, and gave it in hopes of a comfortable resurrection in the presence of the Lord. As to the worldly goods wherewith the Lord has blessed me, I will that they be disposed of in the following manner. First, I will that my sons Michael Carpenter and Harvey Carpenter be my executors, and that they sell such property as they think proper to pay all my just debts. And second, I will that my wife Elizabeth Carpenter shall have the farm which I now live upon, and two Negroes. So there it is. There it is. I was reading this on an airplane. I was going to see my son out in Seattle. And I just put my hand over my mouth, you know, and I was like, just like really exhaling quickly. And it took me so long to take that in. And I'm still taking it in. It just shocks me. It just shocks me. And two Negroes. And there are all these question marks because it was handwritten, I guess, and they didn't know their names. Two Negroes, Juding, or maybe Indying, and Lingley, maybe Singley, for her maintained during her lifetime under the control of the above-named sons, and also I will let the old black woman shall remain with my wife Elizabeth Carpenter. Didn't even give her name. For 3 years from this date, and then have her freedom. And also I will that at my wife's death, the above named Judging Ann Biberia? With Edmund, a young black boy, shall be equally divided between Michael Carpenter and Harvey Carpenter. That sounds to me like a three-person family is to be equally divided. That's what it looks like to me. And the 1830 census shows Michael Carpenter with 7 slaves, 3 male and 4 female. 2 each male and female were under the age of 10. And then going back further, with another branch of the family, we have the will of George Dodson. George Dodson was employed as a Baptist minister in Virginia. He was a minister. And he starts out talking a lot about God. And this is in, he wrote this around 1816. He says, "First I lend to my small blonde wife, Margaret Dodson, my land and plantation whereon I now live, and two Negroes, viz., one Negro man called Simon, and one Negro woman called Sarah, with all my household and kitchen furniture, my cash and yoke of oxen, and all my stock of hog, sheep, and geese, and three cows and calves, and two horse beasts, viz., horse beast for the saddle, and another for the plantation during her natural life, together with my said wives, saddle, and bridle. They listed them in with the livestock, and the saddle, and the bridle. And who knows what horrors were connected with this? Beatings, perhaps? Breaking up of families? Rape? Am I perhaps descended? Am I perhaps related biologically to some of Sally's descendants? It could be. And I suppose that a pretty large percentage of white Americans are descended from slave owners. And so maybe it's not that all that unusual, but it was huge for me. And I can feel it right now. I feel it in my body. It's under my skin a little. It's like electricity when I think about this. And the last thing I want to do is to make this about my disappointment and my discomfort. Because that's nothing compared to the real pain inflicted on black people by this brutal system. But what I do want to talk about, and what I find really interesting, is how badly I wanted all of this not to be true in my own particular case. And I'd actually thought about this before, and I thought, well, I don't really have anything to do with slavery. I can't be descended from slave owners, because I thought we were all Northerners. Turns out not to be true. And I thought we were all pretty poor. All of my ancestors were farmers, and they didn't have much. So I thought, even if they were Southerners, they wouldn't be able to afford to own slaves. That turns out not to be true either. But I think this is instructive, because my hesitancy to entertain this thought that I, Ted, could have anything to do with slavery was a hesitancy to own up to my place in the interdependence of things. I wanted to be one of the good white people. I had credentials. I've been opposed to racism my whole life, you know, since I was six, and I've actively worked against it. But in saying that, I was denying white privilege. Because this printout shows me that I, Ted, directly and personally benefited from slavery. My great-great-great-great-grandfather and his family probably lived a pretty comfortable life. And one reason for that is they had seven slaves to do their work. And so they had a certain amount of physical and economic well-being, and they passed that down to their children. And it's true that my grandparents didn't have much, but in a way they did, because they owned their land. It was a small farm, but they owned it, and land gives you security and comfort. And they came from a solid economic base, so at least they weren't itinerant. They could own their own land. Now contrast this to Sally's descendants. I don't know if she had descendants. I don't know if that could be traced, but I can imagine that she did, and that probably she, or more likely her children and grandchildren, lived to see freedom. And some probably stayed in Kentucky, and some probably found their way north to Detroit or Chicago or Cleveland, and some are probably doing well, and I hope to God they are, but some are probably not doing so well. Because you do not escape the legacy of slavery in one or two or three or four generations. And if racism persists, you don't escape it in 10 generations. So I can say that not only did I benefit directly from this economic well-being in my family, but I have to say I continue to benefit, and that my continuing benefit from my place in society is intimately wrapped up with the difficulties of Sally's descendants, who may now be living in Kentucky or Detroit or Chicago or Cleveland. It's because they are doing so badly that I am doing so well. Even my ability to know about this stuff, to have this printout, reflects my privilege. My ancestors had last names. My ancestors were in the records, and their family stayed intact, and they can be traced. Now, this is all dramatized for me because of this printout, but you don't have to have a printout to reflect on these things. And in fact, all white people, regardless of what their ancestors did, continue to benefit from slavery and from racism that continues today. And that seems pretty obvious to me, but it hasn't always been obvious to me. And actually, it's a fairly controversial statement, because I think a lot of white people say that the past is past and I'm not responsible. I started with very little myself and I built myself up, and everyone else should too. And no one should ask for anything special. And I can see where that thought comes from, but I think it's based on a fallacy. And that's the fallacy that people are born with equal opportunity. They are not. The legacy of slavery and the present existence of racism mean that there is no equal opportunity. To pretend that there is equal opportunity is to deny interdependence. But I'm not here to apologize for what my ancestors did. That was them. That wasn't me. I'm not responsible for what they did in the past. And guilt over what your ancestors did is not going to help anyone. But what I do want to apologize for, and I apologize to anyone who is listening, is not acknowledging sooner during my life that I continue to benefit from what my ancestors did, that I continue to benefit every day from white privilege, and that I haven't done more about that. I am sorry. I am sorry for that. And I've got a little more to say about this, and I hope this part is not misunderstood. If we're going to look deeply, we have to look really deeply. And that means that I have to consider my ancestors in the fullness of their being. I can't simply other them. I can't other my own blood. I cannot eliminate this blood from my veins, even if some of it came in unwillingly. And I can't cut off my own hand. And it's so confusing to me to think of my grandparents and how kind and how loving and how wonderful they were, and to think that they were only four generations removed from this horror. And that DNA that allowed this horror was also present in my dear grandfather, and it's present in me. And the DNA that allowed him to have that wonderful loving kindness and that great equanimity had to be there in his ancestors as well. And I'm sure that that Baptist preacher was kind to his own family. I'm not sure, but it's likely. So we've all got some good and evil in us. Perhaps we have it in different proportions, but it's there. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. And I could add that I am the slave owner and that I am the slave. So some of our interconnections are very beautiful. I am really happy about my 13 ethnicities, and they make me feel good. My joy is like spring. And some of our interconnections are very painful. But the one thing about interconnections, whether they are joyful or painful, is that they cannot be denied, because that is our practice, not to deny these interconnections. And I would like to leave you with a question, which is the title of my talk. And it's a continuation of my theme from practice period, which was about action in the world. And that question is, what does one do in light of this understanding? What does one do in light of this understanding? And you'll note that I said one. I didn't say what do we do in light of this understanding, because I don't want to presume that you share this understanding. I also didn't say what do I do in light of this understanding, because I cannot help but hope that you will share some of what I feel about this, and that you will join me in asking this question. And I may not have gotten everything here just right. I've probably missed some things, and if I did, I hope to be corrected. I see it from my point of view, which is limited. Which is limited. So, thank you so much for listening this morning. And I would love to hear from some of you, if anyone has anything to say.
What company did you use?
I don't want to get it wrong. It's Ancestry.com. Ancestry.com. Pretty good. Yes, James.
Now, these ancestors didn't do what they did, such as slaves having cutters, just all on their own. It was supported by the, a lot of society at that time. And so they were in an environment very different from the one today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you need to bring in the surrounding influence of what it was like in large part among people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In this country.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, yeah. And one wonders what blind spots we have, because everyone is doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
Because I think we're really not that far away from it, because, like, my own grandmother was a part. But it's really hard for me to understand how she could have been quite as racist as she was. And my mother was really racist. For example, my grandmother had a huge Cadillac, and I went to visit her when I was 18 in Philadelphia. And if she'd see a black person walking down the road, she'd swerve over there and say, I'm going to hit that blank. And it was just, like, how is that actually, to me, almost as removed as actual slavery, because it's so hateful. And I started thinking, what does that mean for me to have experienced that in my family? And my mother used to love to have coffee at a restaurant in Portland, Oregon. It was actually called Little Black Sambo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like this stuff is, in some ways, very much in my present. I mean, maybe it's just for me. Maybe other people have been really lucky and didn't grow up with that kind of racism in their family. It's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Raymond.
I think it's easy for us to look back at history. But I think it's not as easy for us to realize they call it slavery or not. It goes on right now. We benefit from it right now. Mm-hmm. We eat right now in the wintertime, the vegetables, a lot of it comes from Mexico, and it's very immigrant workers, same condition. The clothes that we use, our cell phones, and it's kind of masked from us because we don't see it. We don't
mm-hmm.
do it. It's nobody that we know. But we benefit from that slave labor. And I would also put forward that, in my opinion, our economy has never gotten over that. Maybe they weren't slaves, but they were immigrants, be it Chinese or Irish or Italian or now Mexican or Latin American. And we are interconnected. But it's not as far as we think.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not as insulated as we would like to believe, in my opinion.
Thank you. That's a very good comment. I'm focusing more on the historical, but You're exactly right. It's going on now as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, Bernie.
I just wanted to say that Ray's comment just struck me that, you know, up through the labor movement in the early 20th century, we had this concept of wage slavery that, you know, comes from people who don't have the land that their grandparents had, and they have no choice but to work on wages. And it's, you know, it's not little ownership, right? It's a similar concept. And I think maybe it's time to start reminding them. I also wanted to say very much thank you, Ted, for being willing to look back and with an unblinking eye at the uncomfortable.
Thank you. Yes. Hi.
I have a question about a death, balancing the idea of not wanting to other people and also acknowledge interdependence and interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
I guess because it's important to me, not to other people, but also, don't take this the wrong way, let's hear a white man say that he's Arab, like that's almost less genetically speaking you are, but if there's an Arab person in the room, that's almost like too much lacking otherness. Like, you're not necessarily... Do you know what I mean?
Lacking otherness. I'm not sure. You mean, I mean, I can say that I'm an Arab, but in sort of practical reality,
right,
that's not really there. And I would agree with you, too. And I'm not, you know, that for purposes of saying that we're all connected, this is a helpful thing. But for me to sort of, you know, publicly claim that there's something not quite right about that, because it's such a small trace, and discrimination suffered by Arabs is not anything I'm suffering. Did I get what you were saying?
I understand that. It's just, it's hard to say, yes, I feel interconnected with my community that has struggles that I, you know, don't understand, but also I don't want to identify with them so much that I'm kind of stealing their struggle and claiming it as my own.
Oh, I get that. Right, right. If I were to really sort of play this up, I am claiming their struggle as my own, and what's the word? No, but you're saying that can happen, right? Yeah, and that's very good. That's very good, and yeah. I mean, one thing that occurs to me here is I really need to listen a lot more. No, yeah. Yes, Rocio.
I'd like to say something about, I think it's a different topic, because one, when you say I'm an Arab or a black person, if you're talking to a person who is aware of oneness, and that we are the one thing, same thing,
mm-hmm.
When you come from that understanding, I will never be outraged that somebody said a black person says I am white, or a white person says I am black, because you're coming from that understanding. We are one, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two different topics. I went into a woman from, she was Muslim, and I kind of said something that she said, no, I am not the same, I am different.
Mm-hmm.
I have my own. This and this, and I immediately realized how she lives by her senses, and when you live in your senses, it's very difficult to understand. I am you and you're me.
Mm-hmm.
There is no difference. You're trapped in the mask, you're seeing superficially, so you cannot really see what is. So there's two different topics. So you talk to a person, and you first realize where are you at in this oneness understanding. Because if you are not, they could be offensive. But if they are one, they say, of course we are. It's
mm-hmm.
our power.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes?
I just kind of wanted to make a point in relation to slavery. That it's still going on, it's still going on in the country in a different form. When the Civil War ended, the 13th Amendment said that slavery was abolished except as a punishment for crime. And then the South needed to rebuild after the war, so I mean, many simple things became illegal, and pretty much everyone that was freed by the 15th Amendment is now in prison, working for private prison industries, being slave labor, helping them rebuild. And it's still going on today. But pretty much all of us have probably eaten something or bought something that was produced by slave labor. I have potatoes, bone, black bean, Martin, all benefit from it. Many cheaper cell phones, clothing. And there's a very good documentary about this called The 13th that
yes.
everyone here can check out. That really dives a lot more deeply into that subject than I can touch on and really lays the groundwork for us here. But it is something that's still going on. And I know you said that you don't feel guilty about what your ancestors did because that's something that they did. Personally, if I had ancestors in the same group, I would, you know, that's something that they did. That's not something that I feel. But when it comes to that white privilege that we benefit from, something we don't realize is 3 out of every 5 black men will end up in prison or jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have, you know, I watched this documentary of the Tennessee Crime Bar Association, and there was a black lawyer there who, between her and her sister, had 5 kids. And she says, I already have to think about that 3 of my kids and or nephews will end up in jail. And it's something she has to think about every day. So she brings them to school and tries to get them very involved in like doing better things so they don't get dragged into other activities, but it's still very well can happen, you know, based on other standards of discrimination or profiling or whatever. So, you know, that's one way we benefit is, you know, we're not looked at like criminals. And you know, I'm not saying that people here look at everyone else like criminals or whatever. It's just something that happens in our society, and that's one of the ways we benefit, is to sort of boss over in that term. But something, I guess where I'm going with all this is the only guilt I maybe feel right now is that I know that there is sort of this thing going on with the private prison industry and slave labor there, and that's something that like, I personally feel guilty that I know about that I'm not really doing something about.
Mm-hmm.
Because prisons should be more about rehabilitation, but it's kind of a front to modern day slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely something to check out, and there were some strikes going on in South Mississippi, large scale prison strikes because of those conditions, because they're getting paid literal pennies an hour to do this work, and they said, no, this is, we're not going to do this. This isn't right. So it's just something to look into, and if, you know, like I said, I think that's really important. The thing I feel really about in terms of this, my privilege, is that I'm probably never going to end up in prison, and I want to do something to help actually rehabilitate people over there, which is something
Thank you very much for your comments. Anyone else? Okay, well, I'm going to... Oh, we have another... Yes.
Thank you for this kind of dramatic example. I started taking it to some more subtle examples in our daily existence into other areas that are like how we may or may not work with the LGBT community or even our gender relations or certain discriminations that we think are sort of acceptable now, but they really aren't. That, you know, a few generations from now we'll go, wow, I can't believe we did that.
Right.
But yet, so my challenge would be, how do I take it into some of the more subtle things versus some of the more dramatic example there?
Very good. Thank you. Okay. Now I think we'll turn it over to Raymond for some announcements.